First of all, thank you. It's a great honor to be here today. If I'm unclear on any point, feel free to stop me and ask questions. I mean for this talk to be understood. Also, I'm wondering how many people consider themselves experts in global optimization? Yeah, the first part of this talk is introductory, so presumably then that will not bore too many people. Okay, the first thing I'm going to talk about is the difference between local and global optimization, which in the past has been blurred. It's becoming clearer now that we can actually have some hope of doing global optimization. And previously, we couldn't, so we just made do with local optimization. Okay, here is mathematically how we pose the general problem, although perhaps it's not the best idea to try to always solve just the general problem. We want to minimize a function of n variables subject to equality constraints and inequality constraints. Now, we also might, instead of writing general inequality constraints, write bound constraints because they can be handled specially. Okay, and also I'll continue from there. Okay, so what's the difference between local and global optimization? Go back to your calculus course. Okay, imagine that, this axis to be n space, and this axis to represent the objective function values. So I'm, to make it easy to draw, I think of this as Rn. And imagine the function to be unconstrained. So from your calculus, you know that to find an optimum, one thing you can do is set the derivative equal to zero and thus find critical points, or find points where the derivative is undefined. Okay. So all of the points you see there with horizontal tangent are critical points. The ones shaded in black are what are called local optima. There's a region in N space, or if we're looking at the constrained problem, a region of the intersection of N space with the set satisfying the constraints, such that in that region, that point has objective function value greater than any objective function in this sufficiently small region. Now, the global optimum is this. Okay. Assuming that we're optimizing over the region that we see. Okay. All right. Now, local optimization is, well, I think of it intuitively. It's where you start a ball at rolling at the top of a smooth surface, and it rolls down to one of these little valleys. Now, a lot of development during the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, in fact, almost exclusively, mainstream development of optimization was concerned with such local algorithms. Okay, the model is steepest descent, where one takes a step in the direction of steepest descent for unconstrained problems. That's a direction of minus the gradient. For constrained problems, you can think of it in a direction of the projected gradient with somewhat more complication with inequality constraints. And then repeat that in some way until you get down to the bottom of one of these valleys. And there are many variants of this, many of which are used in practice extensively still. There are trust region algorithms developed for this. There's what's called the dogleg line searches, searching in the direction of descent for an appropriate next point, have been studied extensively, and some convergence theory there's a lot of convergence theory for this. Now, the algorithm developers speak of globalization, but they only mean that they're designing algorithm variants such that the set of starting points for which the algorithm will converge to some local optimum is bigger than other algorithms. That's what they mean by globalization. They mean increasing the domain of convergence. Along those lines, think of instead of going in the steepest descent direction, think of going in the direction defined by Newton's method applied to the gradient equal to zero. And then Newton's method doesn't converge. If you modify the step length in that direction, you can increase the radius of the domain of convergence of Newton's method. Okay, so these are workhorses that are still quite used for many problems. Okay. Now, let's consider, when do we want to do global optimization? Okay, the global optimization is a much harder problem in general than local optimization. Finding one of those local optima is relatively easy. It can be done for problems for which global optimization for which we don't know how to do global optimization yet. Okay, so let's consider a couple of hypothetical examples, which might not be so hypothetical. They're all from my experience. Okay, suppose a large corporation is running a plant that presently costs $50 million a month to operate. Okay, and you've got a model of the plant operation, and there are certain parameters that you can control. And so by choosing optimum parameters, you can decrease the cost to the minimum possible. Okay, globally optimum, you get the minimum possible. Now, we don't know when we're starting this computation how close this 50 million is to even a local optimum. Okay, so you run some software, maybe just a local optimizer, and it results in a set of parameters that gives a 5% lower objective value, and you implement it, and indeed, in practice, it gives that. Do you think the plant manager will be happy? I would think so. Now, if the global optimum is significantly lower, he probably would be even happier, okay? But if we don't know how to get it, this 5% is fine, okay? All right. Now, let's consider the following, a protein folding problem or something like this. Okay, if phi represents the potential energy of a particular conformation of a molecule, okay, the globally lowest value for phi gives the most information. It's probably It probably is the state in which most of these molecules find themselves. So it's probably the state that's most predictive of the biology associated with that protein. Okay. However, some of the molecules might reside not in this lowest energy state, but in a state corresponding to a local minimum. So the local minima are of interest. And we might run an algorithm that perhaps finds the global minimum, but perhaps not. But in any case, we'll find local minima. And we could explore with that algorithm. We might not have a guarantee that we found the global minimum, but we have some kind of idea that we're looking at local minima, and we might run the algorithm over and over and get different local minima. We can use that as a tool to explore and hypothesize, although we don't have solid proof that we have found the global minimum. Okay? So that's another situation where we'd like the global minimum, but we can still we might not be able to know that we found the global minimum, but we still might have a tool that allows us to explore and give us some information. Okay. Now here's another situation. Okay. Now, a mathematician has reduced the proof to showing that the objective function is greater than or equal to 1 everywhere. Okay. All right. Now, the proof might be of something, it might be pure, or it might be of something that's directly related to some application of interest outside of mathematics. So this could be of practical importance. It could be a pure result. Okay, well, if all of the objective values that we've found are greater than or equal to 1, that's still not a proof. Okay, so what we need to be able to construct an algorithm that not only gives the global optimum, but proves that we have, but gives rigorous, mathematically rigorous bounds on that global optimum, and proves that you can do that. Okay. Now, in some instances, we can actually, using computer arithmetic, do that. There are some renowned cases recently. The sphere packing problem is one of them. Another one is there are several proofs of chaos. Okay, that chaos occurs in certain dynamical systems. Okay, but that requires a different kind of algorithm. We might not be able to apply that algorithm in the first two cases I listed. Okay, although we're working towards doing so. It would be nice to. Okay. Now, more on global optimization. Global optimization is NP-hard. Now that means that we know no algorithm that solves the general problem that I put up efficiently for all problems with a large amount of data. And in fact, even if you restrict the problem to some very specific cases, for example, if the objective is quadratic, okay, and the constraints are linear and quadratic programming, and the Hessian matrix, that constant Hessian matrix of the objective, has at least one negative eigenvalue. Okay. So that seems like, you know, if it has only one, it's still NP hard. Okay, so that seems like a really special case that shouldn't be, but it is. Okay. Or, yeah. Okay. So any general, and of course people have conjectured that there are no algorithms that solve such problems efficiently. So, barring discoveries that are going to really shake a lot of fields, any general algorithm will fail for high-dimensional problems. Furthermore, there are some lower-dimensional problems that are difficult for global optimization. However, if we take advantage of structure, okay, if we design the algorithm specifically for a specific type of problem, we can sometimes obtain success. Okay, that general algorithms that the present ones don't achieve. Okay, and of course you could subsequently put features of that specific algorithm into the general algorithm, but then there'll be other problems and so on. There's no lack of work for consultants, if you will. Okay. Okay. So we can take advantage of structure. We can also replace guarantees that we found the optimum by heuristics. Okay. So also advances in algorithms for general problems, as well as advances in computer speed over the past 30 years, okay, global optimization, actual computation had its infancy in the mid-70s, I believe. Okay, so in the past 30 years, computer speed has increased substantially, but it's questionable whether that was the main thing that has allowed more problems to be solved, because algorithm construction we've learned how to solve these problems in general. We've learned a lot in the past 30 years. So that's gone hand in hand with computer speed. Okay, so what general approaches might we have for global optimization? Okay, well, I view the approach is as falling into a kind of a menu tree, if you will. Okay, there are two overall approaches, stochastic and deterministic. And among the deterministic algorithms, they can be either rigorous or heuristic. Okay, and I'll explain that. Now, okay, the stochastic algorithms have a statistical or a random component to them. All of them do. Most rudimentary one would imagine blindfolding yourself, and someone aims you at the feasible set, and you throw a dart at it, and if you manage to hit the feasible set, then you evaluate the objective function at that feasible set. Okay? And you do that repeatedly, as many times as you can. Maybe you have all your buddies doing it too, so you do it in parallel. And then the lowest value of the feasible set, the lowest value on the feasible set that you found is taken to be the optimum. Okay. All right, and then there's some more sophisticated ones, okay. But they all have a random component. Simulated annealing is, well, it's like these local optimizers, where you do something like steepest descent, but it's modeled on the metallurgical process of annealing, where you repeatedly heat and cool a metal. When you heat the metal up, okay, the molecules are more active, okay, and they can go out of their resting energy state, and then when you cool it down, they tend to cool down to a minimal energy state, but it might not be the global minimum. Now, the metal is strongest when it's at the minimal energy state. This is the theory, okay. And so when you heat it up and then cool it slowly, the molecules can jump from a locally minimal energy state to another state where when they cool down, they go to the globally minimum state. And so simulated annealing is where you do a steepest descent, basically. I'm oversimplifying it. Okay, so I recommend you read the literature if you're interested. But you do a steepest descent, except that with a probability that depends on a parameter called the temperature, you go uphill. Okay. And this allows a jump from a shallow local minimum to a domain of attraction of a global minimum. Okay. Now, genetic algorithms basically mimic sexual reproduction. Okay. You have components called genes. And a simple way of allocating genes to this problem would be to have each coordinate in N space correspond to a gene. And the value of that coordinate would correspond to a particular instance of that gene. Okay? And then basically, you have a large population of these. It's just a large population of vectors in this case. And then they reproduce, you reproduce these things by taking two of them, taking half of the genes randomly chosen from one, half of them randomly from the other, and then having that be a new individual. And then if the objective function of that new individual is high, with a finite probability, you delete it from this population. If it's low, you keep it. Okay. And then there are processes where you randomly change one of the genes. This corresponds to mutation and so on. And this is, again, with large populations, this is suitable to parallel computation. In fact, algorithms in this have become popular I recently reviewed a book on supply chain software, and evidently these algorithms are called evolutionary algorithms there, and they've become popular in that area of operations research. Okay. All right, now deterministic algorithms. You either need to, deterministic algorithm is if you use exact arithmetic and allow the algorithm to run until it completes, which might not be practical, but if you do, then you're guaranteed that what you get is a global optimum. Okay. Now, one way of knowing that you've got the global optimum is looking at problem structure. For example, if the constraints and the objective are convex, it has only one local optimum, and that local optimum must be the global optimum. So you can use one of these well-developed local optimizers, and then since you've analyzed and know the problem's convex, you know you found the global optimum. Okay. Otherwise, you need to do some kind of systematic global search over the entire domain. Okay. And the usual way of doing this is in some kind of branch and bound process. Okay. Now, the branch and bound processes somehow rely on estimates on the ranges of the objective and constraints. If I draw here, can everyone see? Yeah? Okay. As an example, let me explain. Okay, suppose we want to optimize over this region. And again, the region defined by the constraints could be quite complicated. I'm depicting it here by this line segment. Okay, so we've got this, and all right, so basically, if we evaluate the objective at a point, and well, if the objective corresponds to a feasible point, okay, we get and there's more to be said on that. I may not have time to go into that, but there's a lot to be said on constrained problems in this process. But that objective value is an upper bound for the global optimum. Okay. Now, what we do is we go about our business subdividing the region in some way. Okay, and suppose we've subdivided it and we're considering this region. Let me call it backslash X. I use that for boldface. Okay. So here we've got this region, bold X. Now, suppose we can obtain a lower bound on the range of the objective over that subregion. Okay, let me call that phi lower bar. Now, if the lower bound on the range is greater than this upper bound on the global optimum, we reject that region. Okay, now it might be that in a particular subregion, say in this subregion, the lower bound is here, the lower bound is lower than this upper bound. Okay, And so we can't reject that region. In that case, we continue to subdivide. And when we subdivide, we generally our lower bounds get more accurate depending on how we compute the lower bounds. And also, we tend to isolate the global optimum more. And so regions that are small that don't contain the global optimum tend to get rejected. So that's the branch and bound process. Okay, actually this is borrowed from the most common process used in integer programming, where you've got a linear program, but some of the variables are integers. I'll say a little more on that later. It's a similar technique. Okay, now the estimates on the range, here the estimates on this range can be either mathematically exact or they can be heuristic. If they're mathematically exact, if you compute a floating point number that's guaranteed to be lower than that range, and if you compute this in such a way that it's guaranteed to be greater than or equal to the actual function value, then we obtain a mathematically rigorous algorithm. Okay. Otherwise, we obtain a heuristic algorithm. Okay. Okay. And the mathematically exact x estimates can be, well, I kind of mixed my terminology here. Okay. We can use statistics to get the lower bound on the range, or we can assume that it would be mathematically exact if we used exact arithmetic. Okay, now the mathematically exact estimates can take account of rounding error, in which case they're rigorous, or they can not take account of rounding error, in which case there's a chance you don't have a global optimum because of rounding error, but you probably, in many cases, do get a global optimum if the algorithm completes. Okay. All right. So, branch and bound algorithms. Well, I just did that, didn't I? Okay. Just a minute. Okay, here's the abstract algorithm, which I've already mentioned. I'll let you look at it for a minute or two. Okay. All right, so that's, and by the way, these are going to be posted. Okay. All right, now, more on this. Some algorithms rely on Lipschitz constants to obtain this lower bound. Okay. That's one way. And these can be determined in some cases exactly, or in some cases heuristically. Okay. For example, Janos in his LGO software uses a statistical technique to obtain estimates for the Lipschitz constants. That's right. For black box functions, you can't do an exact algorithm. Yeah, right. Right. There's no alternative. Okay. All right. Or if okay, it may be obtained if you know the structure of the problem. Okay, with outwardly rounding interval arithmetic or non-rigorous interval arithmetic. Okay, and there's another technique that has been used recently for continuous problems, and it's been used a lot for these integer programming problems I had mentioned, and that is relaxations, where you replace the objective by an objective whose values everywhere are less than or equal to the values of the original objective. And then you replace the constraints by constraints such that the new feasible region contains the old feasible region. Okay, that's called a relaxation. It increases the feasible set and reduces the value of the objective function. And when you do that, the resulting optimum is less than or equal to the optimum of the original problem. And if you constrain the optimum to be over a particular box, that optimum gives a lower bound on the objective. And that lower bound on the objective you can use in the overall over the box, you can use in the overall algorithm. Now, the relaxation technique is such that the new problem, the relaxation, is a lot easier to solve than the original problem. In particular, what's become popular and is in use in a couple of commercial global optimization packages now is linear relaxations, in which you replace this hard global optimization problem by a very, usually rather large linear program. All right, so this, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay. All right, I mentioned this, and the software in which Janos does this is called GAMS LGO. Okay. And I, yes?
I just made the assumption that GAMS is a modeling language, and LGO is one of the solver options for GAMS.
So LGO is available outside of GAMS too. It's available through NEOS, right?
No, because there's some geopolitics
happening there, but otherwise. Oh,
okay. All right.
Oh, okay. Anyway. Okay.
Sure.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, well, in any case, we're going to hear more of that in a few minutes. Okay. 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 Now, here I mentioned what I mentioned before. You can obtain an approximate upper bound here by running a constrained local optimizer. And there's some pretty good ones out, some of them in the public domain. There's the COIN project, for instance, Committee on, what is it?
CoinOR?
Yes, yeah. CoinOR, right, has a pretty good one. It's called IPOPT. And they're working on an industrial strength LP solver too, although the jury's still out on that. Okay. But that's not rigorous because the main problem is knowing that the point it finds is feasible. I have a paper out on how you can do that rigorously, and I've made some improvements to that since that paper. But it's a little more complicated to know that the point's feasible, especially in the presence of binding inequality constraints and equality constraints. All right. And now also I'd like to mention, I'm going to quit here before I get to the interval stuff. because I'm running out of time, and this is, but I'll be around, and I'm available through the internet. But these general algorithms, as I just explained them, you cut and then delete and then cut and then possibly delete, are not efficient enough to be industrial strength, usually. Why? Well, consider if you're using an n-dimensional box. That is, you've got bounds, the search region is bounds on all of the variables. And you cut the box by bisecting one of the intervals representing the coordinate bounds. You get two boxes. Okay. In n space, to decrease the diameter of the box by a factor of 2 requires 2 to the n boxes. So, like 200, if n is 200 or 1,000, you don't want to do that. So, you need to use acceleration procedures. And here are some of the acceleration procedures that you can use. You can use constraint propagation. Interval Newton methods are a possibility. Now, Neumeier and Scherbina back in 2002 wrote a small paper that has been since been probably very heavily cited on how you can if you have a linear program and you've got a solution, you can get a rigorous lower bound on the solution by looking at the duality gap and using interval arithmetic, just a few operations involving the duality gap. You can also, using a similar technique, prove that a linear program is infeasible in many instances. Okay, and so such things can be used to accelerate this branch and bound process in conjunction with relaxations. Okay. And really, I'm convinced that the practicality of a particular code on a test suite is going to depend on not on whether these occur, but how they're combined and in what order and how they're implemented. Okay, if they're implemented in a fast way. Okay. Well, this is probably, I will not subject Janos to having to talk after 3 hours of my talk. This is probably a fairly good stopping point. The remainder of the talk deals with interval techniques, and well, I've mentioned rigor versus non-rigor and when you might want it and when you don't, and that's kind of the underlying philosophy of interval techniques. In the remainder of the talk, I try to point out kind of some of the pitfalls and some of the directions that we can go to improve these techniques. Also, I invite you to look at my web pages where I have some previous talks, some of which give successes with interval techniques and in particular with GlobeSol, which is the interval techniques that we're using. By the way, the research project that we started 2 years ago, okay, GlobeSol, actually the main thrust for that was back in 1998, and I've been working with it since then, mainly as a research group. But what we started 2 years ago was assembly of a library for interval computation, which would include the basic operations, constraint propagation primitives, quadrature ODE, rigorously validated numerical computations where practical. So that's the big project that the multi-person project that we're looking at.
Can I ask you a question, please, in respect to this one?
Sure.
Do you work with the lead interval guys who also develop software? Like, do you work with Tibor Chandler or with Arnold and this thing, like my mother and company? Do they give you software and then do everything?
That is the model we're working on. We're working on the model of essentially being librarians and being essentially an editorial board, okay? And we're planning to develop ties with Toms and so on, okay? And we've written out specifications. We're also active in the standardization of interval arithmetic in C++. Okay, does that answer your question? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, are there any questions? As I say, yes. Well, I accidentally locked the computer. Who knows the password? No, let's do that. Okay, so the current software, the leader from the point of view of tests tests on test suites, and from the point of view of prizes received for the software, is Nick Sainidis's Baron software, Baron. It is an exact algorithm. That is, if you used exact arithmetic, presumably it would be exact. It would give you exact global optimum, and he uses interval arithmetic in places to compute ranges. However, he does not totally take account of Roundoff error, but he solved a lot of problems that's commercially available through GAMS. Now, here's another person who will talk about another software package that is commercially available and that is widely used and has a lot of successes. Okay. I'm sorry. I hit the wrong button. Thank you.